Today is Wednesday, May 19th, 2021. This is part 13 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Nancy Eileen Mulady Meekum, last name spelled Mulady hyphen Mecham. And my name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Nancy. How are you today?
I'm well, Tom. Thanks for asking.
Glad to hear it. Nancy, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you. Nancy, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about was special details. It's like every now and then in a person's career with the Park Service, you get sent out on details. Can you kind of explain to me how that works and then maybe cover some of those?
Sure. Depending upon what your knowledge, skills, and ability are, what we call the KSAs, you tend to go toward some specialties. And for instance, those in protection who are more bent toward law enforcement might try to get on what we call a SET team, a special events team. And those are the ones that are sent to incidents that involve massive response or a follow-up of law enforcement investigations and things like that. Or they get really dressed up and they're there for a presidential arrival or something like that.
Okay.
With my specialties, for instance, I was sent to Yosemite National Park from the Grand Canyon to do some special trainings, in wildland fire and structural firefighting, excuse me. But most of my skills do lie in emergency medical services. And in the 1980s, I had worked as a naturalist at Everglades National Park, but also brought the skills of a paramedic and used them on occasion there. So when you do have these skills, they just don't grab anyone. You have to take special courses within the Incident Command System, the ICS, and become maybe a medical unit leader in wildland fire or a single resource paramedic, or you might become a timekeeper or whatever your specialty might be. Like fires need finance people, so people get paid who are on the fire. And so you are then on either a type 1 or a type 2 team. And if you're on a type 1 or type 2 team, and type 1 and type 2 are differentiated by how severe the incident is. And in a wildland fire, it's usually uncontained, large fire-threatening things. Type 2, maybe not so big, but still needs somebody from the top down to organize things. And these people are together for several years. So you're sent out as your team. And they're not all from the Grand Canyon, for instance. So you're called, let's say, to Organ Pipe Cactus for a influx of people from the southern border from Mexico, and they just can't handle it. So they need a Type 2 team down there. And so people from Tuzigoot and Sequoia and Grand Canyon and Indiana Dunes, whoever's on that Type 2 team, would go down there and rejoin as a team. And then you have a leader and everybody in the different logistics and operations and that kind of stuff. There's also, as I said, single resources. And so in August 24th of 1992, a hurricane hit southern Florida, and that was Hurricane Andrew. And I, as I said, I had worked at Everglades before, and I actually used to give a naturalist talk on hurricanes because there's a lot of history there, Diane and a few others that had hit from the 30s, 40s, 50s, and you'd always get people who goes, well, I remember when, and I remember when. It was really neat to hear people's stories, especially after you've given your natural history of hurricanes. I remember a little ditty I learned and repeated it, and it was about when hurricanes happen. June too soon, July stand by, August look out you must, September remember, October all over. Well, with climate change, that doesn't happen anymore. We have hurricanes all year round, it seems. But back in 1992, Hurricane Andrew hit southern Florida, which included the Homestead area, which is just outside of the National Park of Everglades, and all the way down into the Keys. And they sent Type 1 teams They sent single resources there right afterwards. It was just a mess. The town of Homestead had a lot, I think the majority of the housing there had to have been double wide trailers, single wide trailers, things
oh, wow.
that were not secured to the ground. And I remember one of the talks after that was, well, from now on, you know, nobody gets to have a trailer in South Florida. Well, that's almost impossible. People can't afford things. But these things were just splintered apart. And those who had houses would write, I remember when I went through there in the aftermath, that people would spray paint on their houses, farmers, number 568 to be 48. So they'd write their insurance number on there because there was no way of knowing where this house was. There's no address, no anything. So they all had all these adjusters going through South Florida canvassing the places for insurance purposes. And so people spray painted on the remains of their homes what their insurance information was.
Oh, wow.
And I remember also seeing people that didn't leave. And these are not motorhomes because, or are double whites because those were all destroyed. But I remember seeing one that said, this home guarded by a 357 Magnum and a shotgun 3 days a week. You guess what days they are.
Oh, wow. Oh, gosh.
Yeah, so people, you know, just to yeah. tell people, because there was a lot of looting.
Oh,
a
my.
Lot of looting.
Hmm.
So the National Park Service sent up an incident command system for Everglades National Park, but the whole of Southern Florida was just absolutely devastated.
Wow.
And so they set up big tents, MASH tents, because there were people who were injured, resupply depots, communications. There was no way to talk to anybody.
Hey, Nancy, there you are. You just broke up there. Now you're back.
Oh, sorry about that.
So big MASH tents and then communication.
Communications were very difficult.
Okay.
Because there were pre-cell phone for the most part. And they had satellite phones were few and far between. They were very, very expensive.
Hmm.
And so the first set of people went through, and then they needed to be relieved, you know, because there's only so much time you can spend. We called it a third world country, basically. It
wow.
was just pretty sad. And when you go to Southern Florida in August and September, the humidity is tremendous and the heat is tremendous. And
mm-hmm.
so it takes quite a toll. So I was on a group, I was a single resource that went in September 24th, and I was there till October 14th in 1992. So I flew out of the Grand Canyon airport to Phoenix, and then Phoenix flew in from Phoenix. I got flown to Miami.
Hmm.
And when I got there, I was met by a liaison who picked up these people. And one of the first things they asked me says, do you have any expensive equipment? And I said, no, I have nothing. In fact, I didn't even bring a weapon because it would be too difficult to take that on an aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
Even before 9/11, it was too difficult.
Mm.
And so the person who picked me up explained, he said, it's so bad that just outside the airport is a Denny's. And everybody seems to stop at the Denny's to have a meal before they head into the third world country of South Florida, Homestead South. And so they had in the Denny's closed-circuit televisions that people could see from their tables, and they could watch the parking lot. And more than one National Park Service van was broken into while people saw it real time, because they were bringing communications, and they were, you know, radios, and they were bringing sat phones, and they were bringing computers, and
right.
all kinds of expensive stuff. So it was, there were a lot of people who recognized the government vehicles
wow.
and did that. So I was reported to Everglades National Park, and I was issued, they were running out of weapons at the time, so I was actually issued a revolver, I think it was a 38 Special. And so I was issued that, and I wore it, and I was sent down to Flamingo. And the reason I should say that I was one of the people sent down as a resource is not only was I was a paramedic and had a seasonal law enforcement commission at this time, but I also worked at Everglades, so I knew the lay of the land, and I knew the roads, and I knew all this kind of stuff. In fact, when I worked in South Florida, it was not the safest place. When you worked at, when you went to the local grocery store, a Publix Market, PUBLIX, it was required that a person who worked in the store walk you to your car.
Wow.
So many people got mugged going to their car from the market in Homestead.
Was this because food was short?
No, no. I mean, this was even before the hurricane. This was just South Florida.
Oh wow, okay.
This was back in the 80s when I worked there at Everglades National Park, and on the way to the park was a road called Dead Body Road because that's where all the drug deals went bad. The people who were killed in the bad drug deals were their bodies were dumped there.
Wow.
And you went right by that corner as you drove toward Everglades National Park, and there was a big vegetation stand called Bob's. And they had big alligator avocados, and then you'd work your way to Royal Palm Visitor Center. And as I drove through, as I was driven through Homestead, and I saw, it was just, I didn't recognize anything. I mean, things were flattened, buildings were askew. It truly was. The palm trees and there was a pine tree that's typical of the South called the Florida Slash Pine. All of them snapped in half.
Wow.
It was just amazing.
Did any structures survive?
Some of them did.
Okay.
Some of them did. But there, hopefully some seedlings will come up and replace them. And they also had saw palmetto, and some of the palms did survive. But the slash pine, not so much. But hurricanes go through all the time, so there is an adaptation. I later got my PhD in fire ecology and went back and studied the adaptation of the slash pines to disturbance, including fire. And so they did very well on that. So they don't, they would prefer not to have a disturbance, but they can recover.
And what about the houses? Were there any houses that were still standing unscathed, or was everything? I suppose there was no power.
Before I talk to you today, Tom, I have actually a scrapbook. And I looked through the scrapbook, and I also bought two books. One put out by the Sun Sentinel, which is out of Fort Lauderdale, and the other one is a publisher, Storm of the Century, and the publisher was Dade Book Company, and it looked just, you know, boats upside down, devastation everywhere. Even in the pictures, I can see a handful of places with a roof, but then the walls would be blown out.
Wow.
And so I don't know of any that went, wow, look, that one survived.
Right. So it's like total devastation.
Total is the word for it. Absolute total. So it was just amazing. So I was issued that, and the visitor center at Royal Palm, which was made of cinder block and other stuff, it was devastated. And it's not just so much that the winds and stuff, but the highest point between Royal Palm Visitor Center and Flamingo is a place that is called Rock Reef Pass. And Rock Reef Pass has an elevation of 3 feet.
Oh, boy.
So it's the storm surge. I mean, the buildings, everybody had, 3 to 8 feet of water inside the buildings.
Oh, wow. So it wasn't just a wind event. It was a high water event.
High water event for sure.
Wow.
And it wasn't a tsunami, but it was definitely the storm surge for
right.
sure, which is why when I lived down at Florida Bay, when I worked there, all the permanent houses are up on stilts.
Oh.
And the seasonals live in expendable trailers. I lived in an expendable double-wide trailer.
Got it.
But the visitor center was an older visitor center, and it was devastated. So I went there, and my first assignment was right there at Royal Palm, and the people ahead of me had named it MASH 4077 because we were a first aid place. And we had cots lined up, and a lot of what we took care of, because there were no visitors, was we took care of the people, the firefighters, the people who were working the lines, the people who were trying to pick up debris. So we were there for everybody else, and so everybody was given nicknames. One was named Gonzo, one was Hawkeye. They gave me Radar. That was my nickname, I remember. And so I was there, and I lived in a little scamp trailer, tiny little thing, maybe 8 feet long. And so we would have people come in daily for everything from the equivalent of poison oak type contact to a lot of the casuarinas and other plants. They got chainsaw cuts. A tree fell on them. I had one guy come in one time, and I can tell the story because I'm not identifying the person.
Right.
But I was working there with Patty Haggerty, and I knew Patty from previous working with her in other parks, and she was a park medic, and I was a paramedic. And so this firefighter came in and goes, well, I need to talk to somebody. And Patty said, okay, what's the problem? He goes, well, it's a personal problem. And Patty looked at me, and I go, well, I'm married, so why don't we go in the other room and talk about personal things?
Sure.
And Patty wasn't married. And what happened is when he dropped his pants, one of his testicles was greatly enlarged.
Oh.
And I said, does it hurt? And he goes, no. And I said, was it sudden? He goes, yes. He goes, I was, you know, digging, you know, trenches or something like that. So I'm going, ooh, oblique strains, this kind of stuff. So I said, just a second. I took out my stethoscope, put it on the scrotum, and with her bowel sounds.
Oh,
so
wow.
I said, what you have here is an inguinal hernia.
Yeah.
Part of your intestines has gone down through the hole of the spermatic card, and it's in there. And that's why it doesn't hurt. But the longer you leave it, the greater chance of twisting that piece of intestine, it getting gangrenous, and then you get a huge infection and die.
Right.
So he, for instance, is an example of somebody we got out of there, sent to Miami for immediate surgery.
Okay.
For instance.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
We would, you name it, we saw. We were more of a MASH clinic than we were anything else. And so I worked there for a while, and then I went down to Flamingo. And Flamingo was where I had worked, and I was staged there for a while. And it just stunk because all of the water that had been in the rooms, you know, they just leave behind growth. And things grow so fast. And there was a place called Eco Pond, which was a freshwater pond separated from the brackish Florida Bay by a strip of beach and campground. And it was just denuded. I didn't recognize it. I used to give great bird walks there, and it just was totally different. When I went back a couple years later, it had all grown back. But it devastated. I keep using that word over and over and over again. And you would look up and you would see a canoe in a tree, a motorboat upside down on the shore. And the military was there too. The American Red Cross, the military, we were all kind of a big, you know, group of people. So I was down there for a while and took care of stuff. And then the resource out of Biscayne Bay was moving on, and so there's another national park area at Biscayne, so I got moved over to there, and that's when they really, one of the reasons I was moved there is I was the only ranger, the only thing for that whole marina area, and so it had to be somebody who had a gun and who could use a gun, somebody who was also a medic. So I did triple duty there, and that one, you know, the pier was broken, boats were, again, up on shore and on land. It was just, you know, it was just amazing. And so I was there to be a part of the, you know, the people are using giant cranes to lift these boats off of buildings and out of trees. And I'm there to make sure they aren't hurt, making sure nobody comes in and loots, making sure that you know, the National Park Service interests are being met. And one day we got a call to a plane crash. So I jumped on the boat, and we whipped out on the boat, and we went out there past Elliott Key, and it turns out that it was an old plane crash that the swirling waters had demucked, and it had enough float to come to the surface. We don't know how many years ago it had happened, but it wasn't a recent plane crash, and that was kind of neat.
Huh.
So then they had one of the funnest things for me is they had a float helicopter, a helicopter that could actually land on the water as needed. It would prefer not to, but it did. So I got to go up into this helicopter and get a lay of the land and see what it was that I was protecting. I'll never forget an old flagpole that was probably 60 feet tall, bent in half at a 45-degree angle at Boca Chica Key. And so I also worked with Denver Service Center people, and the people at Denver Service Center are the people who come out to national park areas And they're the architects. They are the people who plan landscapes, plan, can you build this here? Can you not build that there? So they came to see what the damage was.
Hmm.
What would it take to fix this lighthouse? What would it take to put housing back in here? So I also was then the guide for these people, since now I knew the area.
Right.
And the person I was replacing was a guy named Ron Parrish. And so he was on his way out, and I was on my way out. I'm looking at a picture right now in my book of the two of us together, and I'm fresh and clean and, you know, spry, ready to go. And he's just dripping with sweat. He's got 3 days' growth of beard. And he's just had it because he's been there for a month as well.
Yeah.
So,
gosh.
So just going through all of that was just incredible. The U.S. Coast Guard would come by and make sure everything was okay. And we would go out on boats and do boat patrol as well. I remember working with Bill Hudson, who later I remember worked in Arizona at, help me out here, just south of Flagstaff.
Not Wupaki, not Tuchkut?
Wupaki.
Okay.
No, not Wupaki, south of Flagstaff.
Montezuma Castle? Montezuma Well?
No, it's right south of the town of Flagstaff. It's not Sunset Wupaki, but just south.
But it's Fort Tuthill. I'm trying to think of a service unit that's down there for Park Service.
Yeah, no, it's more to the east of it. But anyway,
Walnut Canyon.
Walnut Canyon, thank you. But anyway, he actually moved there. He was the ranger at Elliott Key, so he knew the area very well.
Hmm.
Well, in the same spirit of the Grand Canyon not closing the park for a murderous kidnapper when Danny Ringhorning went through, every October there is something called the Columbus Day Regatta in South Florida at Biscayne. And, you know, it's literally thousands of boats and big party time and all that stuff. And in their wisdom, they decided not to cancel the regatta. And I thought, I'm the only one here. Bill Hudson's over there. So they brought in more people. And I think for all of us, we had maybe 12 people for thousands of visitors. Wait, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 10, 11. No, I take it back. We had 24 people. I'm quit counting the people in our group picture.
Okay.
But people showed up in boats, and they're not allowed to go on any of the little islands, which are called keys, K-E-Y-S, from the Latin Q-U-A-Y. But they had to stay on their boats. So they would, like, tie their boats together and walk from boat to boat. And, you know, I have a picture of a guy with a Budweiser case on his head. You know, he cut out the cardboard and put it on his head, and he's chugging it.
Wow.
And so it's just imagine spring break on steroids.
Got it.
And that's what this was. So it was really, really crazy. And so as a result of that, we were the responders now because it was in our waters. So I got called to many medicals, and I'll never forget the medical I ran. And I was with a man named Glenn, and he later on was part of the responding to the ranger who got shot in Great Smokies. I had met him here. And so Glenn and I were on here, and he was a park medic, and this lady had overdosed. And so we had to get her to an LZ, which is a landing zone, for a helicopter to pick her up because she was barely breathing. So we're bagging her, and we're just zipping around, boom, 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 in the boat. And I was fortunate enough to start an IV as we're zipping along at 30 miles an hour, hitting all the crest of these waves.
Wow.
And it's probably one of my proudest moments to be able to hit that and not last
forever
or something
no
like that.
No kidding.
But we were able to give her some antidotes to some of the stuff she was on, like some Narcan from opioids and things like that, and get her breathing again. Turned out she was also on cocaine. And so we saved her life. But this is just an example of people not getting the on-the-ground picture. We're dealing with, you know, all the rescuers and the looters and all this stuff. And now you bring in thousands of partiers, and
wow,
we are very limited resource here.
That's amazing.
It was amazing, and it was very sad at
least,
the same time.
You know, I was going to say, what did you do for an ambulance? And you had a helicopter for that, so that was, at least you had some air support, but still.
Yeah, well, we had to go to it. I mean, it wasn't like right there for us, so it took a while to get them there.
To boat to them. Wow.
Yeah.
And you're so short-staffed. Huh?
Oh, very short-staffed. Very short staff. So when I finished my work there, I just took a little time off and, took a deep breath before I flew back to the Grand Canyon, but that was, it was just, sometimes it was just absolutely nothing going on, quite boring and sedate and pretty sunsets and amazing to think I'm the only one in Biscayne National Park, you know?
Hmm.
And then the next moment you'd have a car crash of somebody who's not supposed to be in there, or somebody who's coming in and trying to break into the marina store to take the cash, and you'd have to deal with that. And so it just, it was just all this kind of stuff.
Wow.
Yeah.
So while you were there, the detail, I think we might have talked about this, who was covering your job at the Grand Canyon?
That is also one of the things that is a little bit of a sore spot amongst the Rangers. Nobody, except for the people who were there. They didn't bring anybody in to backfill, as they say. If somebody was going on a detail, let's say you were a ranger and you were detailed to Walnut Canyon to work as the district ranger, there is money to backfill your position. So somebody would then move up in the ranks to temporarily fill that person who left.
I see.
And then that person is missing.
Mm-hmm.
And so that money, that usually don't bring a person in. It's not like you can call a AAA team and bring somebody into the major leagues.
Right.
You now are forced to work overtime.
Mm.
You have to cover shifts. And we'll be at you that you say you can't cover a shift, and it's reflected on your not being a team player on your evaluation.
Oops.
Yeah. So a lot of us used to kiddingly say, when this happened, we'd be rich, but we'd be dead.
Right.
At any one time, I remember this statistic, there we were always short 10% of our overall Grand Canyon personnel. Those were the openings. And to fill an opening anywhere in the park took months, because you had to make a decision that you were going to keep that. Let's say somebody transferred out, got a job in Gulf Islands. You're going to say, okay, do we still need the job that person occupied? We do? Okay. That takes time. Now you have to go through the job description and the knowledge, skills, and abilities and say, okay, is this what we still want the person to do, or we want them to be more of a paramedic, or we want them to be an education specialist? Then they rewrite that, and then they fly it. So from the time the person's left to the time they fly, it could be several months.
Wow.
So then they fly it, and it's open for a certain amount of time, and it's open whatever they say. It could be open for 2 months or 2 days. And there are some shenanigans sometimes. If it's for 2 days, they're looking for somebody. If it's 2 months, then it's an all call. And then you might get 300 applications for one position. And then personnel, human resources, we used to call it personnel, would then go through and say, of these 300, who have the basics needed for the job? So let's say it was a patrol ranger. Do they have at least a seasonal commission? Do they have at least their EMT? Do they have, a college education, this kind of stuff, at the time you needed a degree? And so so they get rid of the 240 that didn't qualify, let's say. That left 60. Of those 60 left, they made what they call a certification, which we called a CERT, C-E-R-T. And then people would be impaneled. I was impaneled on several certs. And then you'd go through those, and then you would rate them, the first 10 in order, and then you give those to the selecting official, and the other 50 who are supposedly equally qualified are standing in the wings. And if the selecting official, usually the boss of what that position is, says, no, I don't like any of these, give me another 10. The drawback to that is right around that time, there was a lot of growling. I won't say complaints, but growling, because you get extra points if you had been a veteran, and you get extra points if you were a wounded veteran. So you would get people on the cert with 10 extra points who would not have qualified any other way. And so the selecting official really had a difficult time, because you'd have people totally unqualified blocking the cert, and you can't get to the people who can do the job and are qualified to do the job. You do get people who are wounded veterans who are highly qualified, and you pick them up, and it's great. It's
right.
Wonderful.
Right.
But a lot of times what they'd have to do then is then they just would just let the cert expire and fly it again, hoping those people wouldn't reapply to block the cert.
Hmm.
So sometimes it took months and months, if not a year, to fill a position.
Wow.
So you are always short, whether it's South Rim Patrol, whether it is River Canyon Rangers, whether it's River Rangers or North Rim or Naturalists.
Was that true for maintenance production? And administration?
Maintenance,
and
everybody.
Wow.
Everybody. Huh. Everybody. So that's why we were always so short-handed. And I remember when we're going to talk in the future about my leaving the Park Service in Grand Canyon, but the person who, Carrie Weir, W-E-I-R, who was a fabulous personnel specialist, was specifically taking a class in retirement because you had Grand Canyon, Toosey Goots, Sunset Crater, Walnut Canyon, Camp Verde, all these different places going to region to two different specialists for all the people that needed retirement planning.
Oh, wow.
And so you were like, you know, take a number, please. So she was trying to at least help the Grand Canyon personnel by taking this class to advise people what they could and could not do. And one of the reasons she did that is there was a woman who she referred to region who retired but did not take out health insurance because her husband had health insurance. And right after she retired, her husband, who was not in the Park Service, died, and immediately his health insurance
ceased, canceled. Yeah.
And she wasn't a part of it. She hadn't had a chance to join, and so she was left out in the wind. So she wanted to make sure that people looked at the spousal support, the long-term picture, not just you're going to retire, see you, bye.
Right.
And that just so frustrated her that this happened to that person. And she truly was, there was no recourse for her, absolutely none.
Wow.
So she ended up having no insurance at all, and I don't know whatever became of her. It was very sad. So anyway, you have lots and lots of openings. And so if I were to go out on a duty and somebody had to fill in behind me, they might see if somebody at another park who wanted experience at the Grand Canyon, if their park would pay for them to come. The Grand Canyon, Grand Canyon, Yellowstone, and Lake Mead were the three busiest parks that were not urban as far as law enforcement.
Hmm.
The Grand Canyon and Lake Mead were one and two. So if you wanted the person who is at Toosey Goot or is at Sequoia Kings who might have a structural fire a year,
right,
versus
one
a week,
yeah,
and never have a law enforcement incident, and maybe a medical a month. If you want to get those people in there and give them skills, you send them to the Grand Canyon, and they usually are not left alone. They ride along with somebody, but they're
right.
A backup there.
Right.
So we had some of those situations as well, where people would come in. They also, because of this, and you might have heard of this, is when this was starting to happen more and more, especially after 9/11, and I'll address that in a minute, they were taking people who were not South Rim Patrol and telling them, you are now South Rim Patrol for a month or 3 months. And these were Canyon Rangers and River Rangers and North Rim Rangers and Desert View Rangers. Because after 9/11, people who had permanent law enforcement commissions were sent throughout the United States, and I was sent many places for Homeland Security assignments. And that's because when we thought there were terrorists everywhere, you needed somebody with a level one commission that had a background check who themselves was not thought to be a terrorist,
right,
to go send them to go guard this dam before somebody blows it up.
Hmm.
So I was sent on several Homeland Security assignments. I got sent to guard a dam, which I won't tell you, for a month in August, for goodness sakes. It was just awful. But they then had to send somebody to backfill me, and so I think Marty McCaslin from the corridor had to come up and backfill for me.
Wow.
And a lot of these people who wanted to be more wilderness-type rangers did not appreciate the more urban experience you got as a South Rim Ranger.
Oh, it'd be very different. I mean, South Rim Road Patrol would be very different from
right.
Backcountry Rove.
Mm-hmm. So So in anticipation of this, and we didn't even know 9/11 was on the horizon, they started to do this in the mid to late 90s because of people going out on set teams and single resource incidents and things like that, because people were less short. You would be so unsafe. I have gone out on shift, which we would call our, you know, our time on the job, our shift, and there would be nobody else there. I mean, as far as the south rim. So I would call fee collection, and I would call, you know, who's on the rim, who could back me up. I would call the courthouse and say, Jennifer, you know, do you have your weapon handy? Can you be a backup for me as needed?
Wow.
You know, I'd call Kent, the structural fire chief, saying, you know, please listen to the radio. I might need you to back me up somewhere. You know, so you've got, you know, anywhere from 15 to 30 to 50,000 people a day, and you're it.
Wow. Yeah. That's I would just think that would be terrifying. I mean, it could be challenging. It could be fun, but I'm just like, wow.
For me, it was never terrifying because I was a firm believer that if I had all my ducks in a row, that nothing bad would happen. And it wasn't so much a superstition, but I was prepared. And things did happen, but I would get on the radio and say, okay, you know, get me the helicopter in the air, get engine one en route, get this and that, set a general alarm.
Right.
I got to be good at what I did, and so I had the confidence of that to not be afraid. The only thing I was, and I wasn't really afraid, the only thing I was worried about was response times because of lack of personnel.
Yeah, that's all another issue. Yeah.
Yeah, and when it came to structural fire, we had other people than South Rim on the brigade. We also had the concessions brigade members. And later on, we had Tucson Fire who could help. And we also had the airport fire people that could help. So when I was shift supervisor, I would contact all these people and make sure all of them knew that, you know, I might be calling on you.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Just so you know. Well, that makes sense because, you know, you use the resources that you have and you expand that as much as you can.
Right. And I to me, being prepared was and being organized, I was never scared. I can only say, I can remember being scared one time, and I think I told you this story, that we had a shooting over in the Maswick housing, and a bullet hole went through a apartment complex and lodged in a house, and we didn't know where the shooter was or who was doing the shooting. So Kent Keller and I and somebody else responded. We had M16 rifles, and so Kent said, get your rifles, because this person has a rifle, so we're... It comes from the old adage, you don't bring a knife to a gunfight. You don't bring a pistol to a rifle fight.
Right.
So we got our M16s, and he goes, okay, you go this way, and I'll go this way. We were clearing the area looking for the gunman. And I was working my way up the side, and it was just getting dusk, and I'm just to the end of the building, and I see a rifle barrel come around the corner. And I just froze for a moment, and then I backed up, and I said, identify yourself, and it was Kent Keller.
He'd come around the building.
But I remember the first time I saw that barrel, I felt the surge of adrenaline.
I bet.
But when I was about to shoot somebody, I didn't feel that.
Hmm.
Isn't that funny? But this time I thought this could be the bad guy, and now we're like 2 feet apart with a building between us.
Right.
But we did get the bad guy. He was a drunk man shooting his rifle in his apartment through everybody else's apartment.
Wow.
I know. And these are the stories that I know people need to hear because they want to say, park rangers don't need guns, they don't need body armor, they don't need this stuff. But you know what? Who else is going to answer the gunman in the apartment call?
Exactly. I mean, this is a Mayberry, USA, any small, tiny little town out in the middle of nowhere. How would you not want to have law enforcement there?
Yeah, and we do have, you know, shared, you know, concurrent jurisdiction with Coconino County, but they had one deputy from the Grand Canyon to Williams to Flagstaff.
And I would assume he spent most of his time on the interstate or on Highway 64.
Probably.
Dealing with all the issues that were happening there.
Yeah, and remember Jim Coffey, he was one of those deputies. He got shot. I flew into Flagstaff.
Mm.
You know, and so we went out because we have a memorandum of understanding, and we found this guy. I think I told you the story.
Yes.
We found the bad guy later on in the back roads with the helicopter as I flew Jim to the emergency room. So, there is a time and a place for this stuff, but in between, you don't have to be big caught face in the window.
Right. Right. That's
my philosophy.
That's right.
But But I am a different person than other people. I know that.
And everybody, I think, in law enforcement approaches this differently based on their temperament and their skill level. And how they want to fill that role, how they see themselves in that role.
Right, and that's why some people who come to the Grand Canyon, they don't select people who are FOB, fresh off the boat, if they can help it.
Hmm.
They often, it's too bad in a way, because when I first went to the Grand Canyon, I was hired as a seasonal, which means I worked 6 months of the year as a protection ranger. And then the other 6 months I worked as a naturalist, as you know, at Yavapai Museum.
Right.
And we had three permanents, I believe, and four seasonals. It could be the other way around, but I think it was three permanents and four seasonals.
Mm.
The seasonals can come in, and I remember more than one seasonal coming, and then 2 weeks later, they're gone.
Wow.
That was just not their cup of tea. That is not, you know, what they wanted to do and not what they were to do. You get other people like me or other people who thrive and can handle that really hardcore environment. And I just don't mean hardcore law enforcement, but the call volume and
mm-hmm.
the pressure. And you know that we've had call waiting for the helicopter to go rescue people.
Jeez.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, when I did 11 calls one August day, 11 calls in the canyon.
Wow.
Just me.
Yeah.
That's not counting everybody else who was flying in. So, you know, it's just like, okay, who's next? We're going to drop them off. You take them. Here's the, you know, paperwork.
Right. Who's next?
I'm out of here. Yeah.
Right.
So
yeah.
It's something. And then you get a big incident like the raftlet you described to me that just happened. And that takes, you know, 15 resources away from everybody else.
Oh, absolutely. And this was mm-hmm. a huge bunch of resources that were moved away.
We had a raftlet one time on the river that we flew down on and we staged. And unfortunately for some people coming down in a dory, we commandeered their dories.
Hmm.
And it was important because this raft had flipped. It was a commercial raft. People were in the water, and they were getting hypothermia.
Right.
Historically, the water that came down from Colorado River was in the 80 degrees. Once they put up Glen Canyon Dam and released the water below the level of the dam, it came out at 48 degrees.
Yeah.
Which is why trout thrive, which never thrived before. Somebody
yeah.
produced them. And so you've got people who are losing it. So my job at that point, you know, was not to short haul to the raft or anything else, but to go from person to person in that dory, grab them and say, row, and they would row me to the shore, and I would put them up on it. We're talking August now. You know, it's 114
mm-hmm.
degrees, and put them on the sand and go get somebody else because now they're going to warm up real fast.
Right.
You know, and
right.
the guy who
out
has
of the water.
Wrist.
Yeah.
You know, I stabilize it and go get somebody else. So it's sort of like a really quick triage. You just grab and go and grab and go. And, you know, I wasn't the only one doing this. We had people grabbing, you know, how many people in these raft rifts? 22 more
mm-hmm.
or less?
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got all these people in the water. So you're trying to keep them from dying as quickly as you can. And
right.
as you explained to me, somebody passed away from hypothermia on this most recent call.
Well, I'm not sure that they... The two people under the boat, they got retrieved and they came around. They had hypothermia. I think the person in the river, it sounds like they may have had a cardiac event, cold water shock.
Right. As a result of it, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so luckily for us on this particular call I just described, there were 11 people that I was working with and only a broken wrist.
Okay.
And that was really good.
Yeah.
If you stop and think about it, what the potential was. And that's because we got the call, we zoomed down there, and there were happy boats that we commandeered.
Yeah.
So it worked out great. And it was just, I think, upstream from Phantom Ranch.
Okay.
There's so many calls, sometimes they get mixed up.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
no,
anyway, so the resources have always been shy, but you have to be skilled. And I guess the bottom line is you have to want to do this. You have to want to do this job.
Mm.
And
right.
law enforcement was my least favorite. But if I went there being a structural firefighter, emergency medical service person, and whatever else we did and didn't want to do law enforcement, I could not have done that job like I could. You know, it would have, because it was, you couldn't pick and choose what call you were going to get.
Right.
You know, if you're the only one on, you have to be able to handle that. And so to me, it was just a quick attitude readjustment. If I'm going to do this, I'm going to be the best I can at this. And I was. That doesn't mean I loved every minute of it.
Right.
I don't like running after people and shoving them so they have to fall to the ground and then I have to arrest them. I had one guy who was so big that I grabbed him by the bottom of his jeans and pulled him up in the air, and he flew in the air and landed flat on his face.
Hmm.
And while he was stunned, I handcuffed him.
Hmm.
So, you know, I never in my wildest dreams did I think I would do stuff like that.
Yeah.
But I did, and I was going to be able to take care of myself, my partner, and, you know, make sure the bad guy got what they deserved as far as in custody is
mm-hmm.
necessary. And then the victims got what they needed as well. And that's, you know, we had rapes in the Grand Canyon. We got rape specialists and rape kits, and we took them into the clinic, and we
mm-hmm.
took them to Flagstaff as needed. And unfortunately, on two different occasions, I had two people who cried rape.
Oh, wow.
One was a man and one was a woman. So you just, you never, you know, but you have to take them all seriously. You can't decide, oh, they're faking. They're not, you know,
right.
telling the truth. I mean, but one woman I'll never forget, she said she'd been raped when, in fact, she woke up late for work and didn't want to get another demerit.
Oh, wow.
As it turned out.
That's
yeah,
oh, my gosh.
It took a lot of interviewing and a lot of talk. And when we did all, you know, it was the next day when we put everybody put their notes together and said, this didn't happen the way she said. So I took her in and I said, you know, you were late for work and you didn't want to go to work and get another demerit, right? And she started to cry.
Mm.
Nobody raped you? No. So anyway, but that's what being an investigator is about as well.
Right.
Getting to the truth. But I had other people who were legitimately raped and sexually abused. And when I arrested one person who was a person of high authority and took them to jail, this person later had a heart attack and died in jail.
Oh, wow.
And so I got threatening letters left on my doorstep from that person's family.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, it's not living in the community is kind of hard. Of where you work, but
right, especially a community like, again, Mayberry-sized community where you know everybody.
Yeah, and everybody knows where you live.
Yep, and some people are alcoholics, and some people are, you know, shooting
right.
off rifles, and some people are rapists, and so you know you can't just go, oh well, that's Fred, that's too bad, I'll let him go. No,
the person I saw walking to their car drunk, and I said, don't make me arrest you.
Right.
And they walked home.
Right.
And I said that don't make me do this, because I'll do it.
Right. Right. And they said, oh, yes, you will. And, well, thanks a lot. I am going to walk home. I can do that. It's not that far away.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
It was an interesting job, but I truly thrived. I truly enjoyed the variety. I truly enjoyed being good at what I did because I worked hard to be good at what I did. I didn't want to not do well. And I think the next time we talk, we'll talk about why I left all that wonderfulness.
Okay. That sounds like a plan. Well, with that then, this will conclude part 13 of a Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Nancy Eileen Malini-Meekum. Today is Wednesday, May 19th, 2021. My name is Tom Martin, and Nancy, thank you so very much.
You're welcome, Tom. Thank you.